Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to the 5th Ethnic and Racial Studies Public Lecture, which is sponsored jointly by the London School of Economics and by Routledge, the publishers of our journal. My name is Martin Bulmer, I'm the editor of the journal, and it's my pleasant role to introduce our speaker. John Rex, this evening's speaker, is one of Britain's most distinguished sociologists and a scholar excellently equipped to reflect at the most general level about the significance of race, ethnicity, and nationalism in the contemporary world. In his first book, Key Problems in Sociological Theory, published in 1961, John grappled with some of the central theoretical problems of the discipline of sociology, taking issue with the functionalist canon of the anthropologists A.R. Radcliffe Brown, Bronislaw Malinowski, and Siegfried Nadel, and forcefully adumbrating a Weberian alternative in terms of power, conflict, and a thoroughgoing analysis of values. 35 years later, it is perhaps hard to remember what a stir this book made, but it gave British sociology a theoretical stiffening that it had sorely needed and emphasized for a generation of British sociologists the central role which theory has in the discipline. John's next major work achieved high public prominence. His monograph with Robert Moore in 1967, Race, Community and Conflict, a study of urban processes in inner city Birmingham, which caused acute discomfort in political circles by demonstrating racial discrimination in the allocation of council housing. His interest in race and ethnicity was of much longer standing, but this was the first of a stream of books analysing and theorising the place of race and ethnicity in contemporary British society. For me, among these, two further works stand out: Race Relations in Sociological Theory, which explored central theoretical issues in the study of race, and another monograph with Sally Tomlinson, Colonial Immigrants in a British City, a study of Handsworth in Birmingham. But there are many others, and they continue to appear. This corpus of work is too well known to need extensive description here, but a continuing intent of this work has been to engage with significant theorists and their ideas about the nature of social process, whether it was Marx on the nature of capitalist society, J.S. Furnival and M.G. Smith on the structure of ethnically plural societies, Max Gluckman and Ralph Dahrendorf on consensus and conflict, T.H. Marshall on citizenship, or Talcott Parsons on the nature of social systems. It's often remarked that British social science owes a very great deal to those from outside the British Isles. The social theorists I've mentioned, Malinowski was born in Poland, and Nadel in Austria, M.G. Smith in Jamaica, Gluckman in Johannesburg, Dahrendorf in Hamburg, Parsons in the United States. Our speaker this evening, John Rex, was born at Port Elizabeth in the Eastern Cape and grew up there in a racially divided society of white domination. He studied sociology and anthropology at Rhodes University in Grahamston, moving to the UK shortly after graduation, just as the Afrikaner nationalists were coming to power in 1948. His academic career has been pursued in this country at the universities of Leeds, Birmingham, Durham, and Warwick. For a decade, he was director of the SSRC, then ESRC, Centre for Research on Ethnic Relations, with which he retains an association, and latterly was research professor of ethnic relations at the University of Warwick, where he's now professor emeritus. But John has never been one to treat sociology as purely an academic pursuit in itself, abstract though his interests have often been. He's one of a small number of sociologists, Max Weber, Gunnar Myrdal, Ralph Dahrendorf, Pat Moynihan come to mind, who've led a public career in harness with academic sociology. Even the theoretically austere M.G. Smith was for a time a special advisor to the Prime Minister of Jamaica. John has not, so far as I know, held major public office, but he has sought to be a public voice and has also cut a powerful figure in the academic milieu as he's inhabited. Few who've been with him in a department have been unaware of the fact. As a student, he was active in the South African National Union of Students, and his coming to Leeds in 1949 may have had some connection with being declared a prohibited immigrant by Southern Rhodesia in 1948. My own first encounter with John was about 1960, when he was chairing a meeting in Leeds Town Hall opposing the establishment of the Central African Federation. This late burst of colonialism, you may recall, was an attempt to bring together southern Rhodesia, northern Rhodesia, and Nyasaland under the domination of white southern Rhodesians, fiercely opposed by the then African nationalist leaders such as Kenneth Kaunda and Hastings Banda, whose meetings John chaired. Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Malawi look very different today, but when John writes about race and ethnic relations and of sociology and the demystification of the modern world, he knows whereof he writes. My rather long-winded introduction has a purpose: to introduce our speaker this evening and his distinctive career. He comes to talk to us about problems which are rooted in these enduring concerns, but are, I know, linked also to work that he's been doing more recently, particularly on Islam in Britain and issues of societal integration. It is with great pleasure that I invite John Rex to deliver the Ethnic and Racial Studies lecture to us here at LSE on the problematic of multicultural and multinational societies. John Rex.
Thank you, Martin, for those kind words. May I begin by saying that the last time I stood here was actually in 1968, and it was quite a hairy occasion. Deepak Nandi and I were to be the speakers at a meeting to talk, on the one hand, about Rhodesia, on the other hand, about the question of immigration in Britain. The left-wing students left the so-called teach-in, that's what they used to call them those days, to go and sit in the vice-chancellor's office. The rest of the audience consisted largely of supporters of Enoch Powell, who had marched here from Smithfield. My fellow speaker, Deepak Nandi, stood up to speak and immediately fainted and was carried out. And I was left for an hour and a half to deal with this howling mob of Powellites. So I found it quite scary. I find it scary today for a rather different reason, and that is that if you try to talk theoretically about ethnic relations, you are immediately confronted, as Martin and his deputy editor say in their introduction to this month's Ethnic and Racial Study, you find yourself confronted with a whole range of different, use the Kuhnian term, paradigms. Different disciplines, within each discipline, different foci of interest. Many contributors to the debate who are not in a particular discipline. With great respect, somebody like Michael Ignatieff, whose ideas are widely circulated about nationalism in his book Blood and Belonging. Numerous other people, journalists, particularly the broadsheets, who have their own views, and then for many people these issues are most clearly discussed in Panorama, or they are paxmanized at 10:30 in the evening, and then there are ideologists of all kinds. There are people in what we mockingly call the race relations industry who have their own perspective. And so I look at you and I say, who am I talking to? What I want to do in this situation, some people may expect me, because of my reputation, to say something passionate. What I actually want to do is to try to emphasize conceptual clarity within a very limited and clearly delimited area. Now, this lecture is the Ethnic and Racial Studies lecture, and that immediately draws attention to the fact that there are now two journals. There's Ethnic and Racial Studies, Nations and Nationalism. You won't mind if I push Nations and Nationalism as well here. They presumably are concerned with different problematics. I use the term problematics not in some clever French sense, but simply just to refer to the organization of a set of problems in a subject. And they have different ranges of interest. And of course they are backed by two organizations, departments, whatever. On the one hand, we have ASEAN, which of course counts as its founding fathers, Ernest Gellner, Anthony Smith, although somebody told me Anthony Smith had resigned from the presidency of ASEAN, which is rather like hearing that Jesus has resigned from Christianity, and I would be very sorry. But ASEAN actually makes a big claim to deal with all the issues of ethnicity and nationalism. It's an extravagant claim because its focus is, in fact, on nationalism. The unit and center to which I have been attached, and in which I am now a tenant, concerns itself, was established to look at the problems of West Indian and Asian immigrants in Britain. And then it enlarged its interest to be concerned with migrant minorities in Europe and across the world. And that's what I've been working on. Now, these two problematics are not necessarily the same, although I think that some people in ASEAN, I should say that all my friends in ASEAN are these marvelous graduate students whom we have here studying nationalism in various parts of the world. But insofar as they look at the question of transnational migrant communities, they tend to try to cover it through the term diaspora or diasporic nationalism. And I think that is misleading. And I wrote a paper called The Second Project of Ethnicity, Transnational Migrant Communities, talking about communities which, far from wanting to return to Zion, are trying to get across the world away from where they came from. In fact, I'm very interested in that question of the notion of diasporas, and I think the most authoritative and interesting piece which I've seen on the topic is by an American anthropologist whom I don't know, called James Clifford, who has an article in, I think it's called Cultural Anthropology, Journal of the American Anthropological Association. Now, looking at these two problematics and wanting to develop collaboration between ASEAN on the one hand, the Center for Research in Ethnic Relations, on the other. This is not just introductory, actually, this is part of the substance of what I want to say. I have tried to see whether there is some common core between these two. One possible view is simply to say they are two different set of problems. One is about nationalism, the other is about migrant communities. But I have, from time to time, suggested perhaps that we should be together trying to see if there is a common core of theorizing from which these two bodies of thought stem. Now, in doing this, I have asked myself, I want, though, not to talk about that overall problem about the theory of nationalism, the theory of migrant communities on the other. I want to talk about something more narrow and specific and more complex than that. And that is the problem of multinational societies, which are the metropoles of wider empires. I want to talk in the first part of what I have to say about multinationality, and particularly the British Isles as representing a kind of laboratory for this kind of study. And then secondly, I want to talk about, very briefly, about the problems of post-colonial societies, but more specifically about the question of migration from those societies and the reception of migrants in the metropolis. Now, I'm looking, in a way, for some kind of master concept. And perhaps, I think, 20 years ago, most people, and I myself, would probably have looked to political economy and some sort of Marxist-Leninist or revised concept about economic imperialism. I was never very happy with that because, as a child of empire myself, I was always very conscious of the fact that empires were political things. And I've therefore tried, in very crude terms in what I'm going to say, I wanted to begin by talking about imperial social structures and the nationalist resistance to those structures. That's in very broad terms. Now, of course, presupposed in this, there is a theory of the national state, and what I'm talking about are national states which conquer neighboring states and more distant states and create empires. At each stage when I'm talking, I will be limiting what I'm talking about, and I will be recognizing that there are other complementary theories that have to be brought in, but I want to focus on this particularly. And it seems to me that ideally, when a nation conquers another nation and produces a multinational state or an empire, ideally, if one looks at it in terms of institutions, what the empire seeks to do is to put into those subordinate or colonial territories its own imperial administration. And of course, if one looks at the record of Britain, one has the very interesting phenomenon of the Indian civil service, the Sudan political service, the colonial service, forming some kind of a hierarchy. The institutions which are put in to transform those societies. That is to look at it in institutional terms. But because I'm really concerned with the potentiality for conflict between groups of people, the way I want to put this is just this. That when such conquest occurs, the conquering country puts in to the conquered country, first of all, its own soldiers, then its bureaucrats, then various kinds of economic entrepreneurs to develop and exploit that territory. Sometimes it puts in its own settlers who go to live there, and not least, in some form or another, it puts in its own missionaries to change the religion of the people. And the ideal of empire would, of course, be the destruction of the former institutional and social order of the subordinated society. Looking at the Western European imperialisms abroad, the French ideal more than the British or the Portuguese, was to regard everybody throughout that empire as some kind of Frenchman. And the overseas territories were conceived as overseas departments of France. Of course, that was never completely achieved, but that was an ideal. The British, on the other hand, were famed for resorting to indirect rule, which meant that having subordinated various local political authorities, chiefs and kings, they then gave them a kind of subordinate authority where they could maintain some of their institutions, provided that in the last analysis they served the purposes of the empire as a whole. This was a system of indirect rule. And I suppose one could say that the Portuguese, with the notion of some people in the colonial territories being evoluees who were recognized as Portuguese, was a halfway house between these two. Now, of course, such arrangements are not static. I said there is always resistance to them. And of course, in many cases, the resistance will be violent and ongoing. I've been summoned recently twice by the British Council and the British Embassy in Belgrade to talk to liberal-minded Serbian academics and media people on making nationalism into a constructive thing, and I've been expected to talk about the ideal of multiculturalism. It's hard to do that when people come to the conference table with their smoking guns still on the table. It's a bit unrealistic to talk about a multicultural order. One's talking obviously about conflict resolution from that stage onwards. But then the other thing that happens in this imperial situation is that for one reason or another, and in a sense it doesn't matter which reason, the balance of power between the metropolitan center and the colonies becomes changed. The metropolitan center becomes weakened, as the British manifestly did after 1945. And then what happens? Now, of course, the simplest view of this is that there is a resurgence of a kind of primordial nationalism. I haven't got time here to go into the use of the term primordial, but something that comes from the guts, blood and belonging, as Michael Ignatius says. I don't think that's the best way of looking at it, actually, because what one sees very often is not that full-blooded nationalism, but something else. I was very interested in Chatham House some time ago to hear a paper about Kazakhstan, where the president of Kazakhstan, of whom I know little, but I do know that he's not particularly a religious man, and he is a former apparatchik. But he has to pick up the cause of nationalism and does it through surviving elements, dissident elements of the apparatus. And then he does things like building mosques in the Russian area to irritate them. Now that's a sort of half-cocked nationalism. And I think that similar things can be found in other territories. I'm told that Mr. Shevardnadze is now Greek Orthodox and that he prays. I was even told in Belgrade that Milosevic prays. I would love to have got a picture of Milosevic at prayer. So There is a resort by people, in the first place, by people who were part of the apparatus to running the nationalist cause. And then you get that sort of thing. And of course, behind that, there is likely to be further development of nationalism. Well, now, having said all that, I want to turn my attention first of all to multinational states in Europe, using the British Isles as an example, and then to talk about the post-imperial structure and the post-colonial world, and particularly about the problem of migration to the metropolis. I speak with some hesitancy about nationalisms in this, in these British Isles, because there are many people here who are experts on these things and who know all of the history. However, I think it is useful to talk in some more theoretical terms. Now, at this stage, I do become conscious that that crude overall model which I suggested doesn't completely fit the case. But one of the interesting things there, from the point of view of theoretical development, is that if one finds that this is the case, what is different about the cases that one is now dealing with? And I've tried in the paper, which no doubt may be published one day, I've tried to deal with the different cases, the Welsh, the Scottish and the Irish cases, under several heads. Incidentally, one of the things which becomes obvious as soon as you try to do work as a social scientist in what? In England, in something called England and Wales, in Great Britain, in the United Kingdom, in the British Isles. What is the unit? Even our statistics, it's always very difficult to handle these in Britain, because you always think, oh God, I was looking at England and Wales and I'm trying to talk about Great Britain. And one forgets which of these terms covers which. But clearly, I suppose my main point is that the notion of the United Kingdom is a misnomer. It is a very disunited kingdom, and perhaps becoming more so. Just as I annoyed my Canadian friends when I went up there and they were having a thing at Meech Lake, which they called the Meech Lake Accord, and I called it the Meech Lake Discord. So, let us look under four headings. I want to look at the economic ties which bind these subordinate nations to England. I want to look then at linguistic and religious questions, broadly cultural questions, which have some political significance. I then want to talk about political conflicts, and finally say something about the benign cultural elements in these nationalisms, and try to sort these things out one from another. Now, first of all, as regards economic ties, I suppose, from the point of view of my model and my prejudices, the first thing I would be looking at was the way in which the metropolitan center invested in, carried out economic enterprises in, exploited, and perhaps developed the colonial territory. And of course that has happened in relation to the subordinate territories of Wales, Scotland and Ireland. But I think the striking thing at the present time is that as far as economic ties are concerned, there is an acceptance in the subordinate territories that, in fact, investment now is concentrated in the center. It's concentrated, of course, in the southeast. So that what nationalism does is not to applying itself to fighting against exploitation or achieving economic independence, but actually fighting for a share of the total economy. They're saying, we want more investment in Wales, more in Scotland, more in Northern Ireland, and so on. This, of course, something which is altered insofar as new resources like oil in the North Sea change the economic balance of power. So contemporary nationalism takes a peculiar form in the economic sphere. And the other side of the coin with regard to economic ties is that if one looks at Wales and Ireland and Scotland, many Welshmen and Scotsmen and Irishmen are simply not there. They have migrated. And this means inevitably that nationalist politics are likely to be subordinated to class politics across the whole of the multinational state. Now, certainly, of course, that is true in relation to Wales and Scotland. And this must act as some kind of a brake on nationalism, and this is obviously reflected in the fact that, disappointing though it is to Plaid Cymru and the Scottish nationalists, the majority of Welsh and Scottish people vote for working class people, the majority of people vote for Labour members at Westminster. So the conflict between migration produces from these territories constitutes an additional tie where they get caught up with the normal class politics of the metropolis. And so, incidentally, I'm just going to put in here in an irresponsible way, because I always say some irresponsible things. I've got to every 20 minutes. And I've listened to all the political leaders addressing their conferences. And I've concluded that one stands out above all others, and I want to get registered at an address in North Wales so that I can vote for Plaid Cymru and Mr. Dafydd Wigley, who made much the best speech at his party conference. But let me, being more serious, then turn to the question of what these various nationalisms are about. Of course, as far as the Welsh are concerned, there is quite a strong question about language, of the naming of places, and much more important, of the use of Welsh as the medium of instruction. Now, that is something which is strongly supported by nationalists and needs to be, because if it wasn't supported by nationalism, the children would all want to learn English and go and live in England. And that is much more true of the encouragement of the study of Gaelic in Scotland and Ireland. I gathered at a recent excellent conference in Aston where they explore the question of language and nationalism. I gathered from somebody speaking from Ireland that the outside the Gaeltacht, where they pay people to speak Gaelic, that other Irish children required to learn Gaelic in school and treated with about as much enthusiasm as children in the Soviet Union used to treat their lessons on dialectical and historical materialism. Because they are above all interested in, they need whatever else they do to learn English in order that they should be able to migrate to England, to the the new Commonwealth, the old, is it the old or the old Commonwealth, the white parts, right? Or to the United States of America. So the language, there's a feeling in these sort of nationalisms that language is something which people are struggling to keep alive because the forces of globalization, if you like, are against them. On the question of religion, of course, one has a different situation because the notion of religious tolerance within England had eventually been established, although hard won. So that it was possible to be a non-conformist, to be a Catholic, although we still have in England the notion of an established church. But that establishment does not run to Scotland and Wales and Ireland. The Episcopalian church in those territories, although it exists, is simply one amongst many. So that in those circumstances, either one gets a situation of religious plurality, or one may get, as in the case of Ireland, a politicized religion, as one gets particularly amongst the Paisley Presbyterians. Now, the third thing I want to talk about really is the substance of the matter, and that concerns the actual political relations within these territories. In principle, Plaid Cymru, the Scottish Nationalists, and of course Sinn Féin, well, it's hard to talk of them wanting independence. They are wanting, of course, reunion with the South. In principle, they want that, but in practice, they have had, because of the general balance of power, they have had to settle for less. And, of course, that has meant, in the case of the island of Ireland, partition, achievement of independence in one part, but in the other part, devolution to a local assembly, which, of course, eventually failed, but it was conceded that there should be such an assembly. Then, as far as the Welsh and the Scottish Nationalists are concerned, the Scottish Nationalists are, of course, while still wanting total independence, are concerned to get an effective form of devolution, and are at the moment arguing about the question of whether those things on offer give them sufficient powers of legislation, taxation. Now, of course, in Wales, of course, not only is there not an assembly as there isn't in Scotland, but they do not have the same range of separate civil service institutions which the Scottish have. So there are degrees of dependence. Now, as I should have said before, when I was talking about economic ties, that although it is true that the Scots and the Scottish and Welsh nationalism are inhibited by the fact that the people vote Labour, the interesting thing is obviously in this experimental situation that it has not been possible for Irish politics to be absorbed into the class, Northern Irish politics to be absorbed into the class politics of Britain. The nationalist agenda takes precedence. And even in amongst the majority in the minority, that is John Hume's lot, they do not talk in class terms. They took over originally the civil rights agenda from Martin Luther King in the United States. But then they were forced to move from that simple civil rights agenda to adopting some sort of a anti-partition or reunion or recognition of a connection with Southern Ireland as part of their philosophy. The other thing, of course, about Ireland, which needs no saying, is that a minority of the minority demand the expulsion of the British, reunion with Ireland, and are prepared to use violence to achieve that objective. It's not my purpose at all here to comment on the morality of violence. Only to say this is one variable in the situation. It is, you can't talk about the Northern Ireland situation without saying that it exists, and that kind of violence is a small thing in Wales, the burning of holiday cottages and so on, and a even smaller thing perhaps in Scotland. Finally, let me just say a word or two about what I call the benign aspects of nationalism. Nationalism needn't be such a conflictual thing. There is the I Stedford. In Cardiff Arms Park, they sing Land of My Fathers, and does no harm to anybody. It's an internal form of solidarity, and it's something which is easily accepted within the total society. And of course, one of the ploys of people who want to avoid facing up to the challenging political issues to say, oh, it's all right because we do have this multicultural system, and then they make us look at the benign aspects of culture which are tolerated. Now, let me move on from this to say, what is the significance of talking about this British laboratory? How far is it generalizable? And I want to be quite cautious about this and to say that it isn't universally generalizable even in Europe. It has some application clearly in Spain. It has some application in the former territories of the Soviet Union, Russia, the Commonwealth of Independent States. But it doesn't have application everywhere. I think there's much to be gained of interest in the comparison between Catalan and Basque nationalism with the various British cases. There's also, obviously, some mileage to be got out of this in looking at the divisions in France on the question of subnationalism, although these are not as strong as they are in Spain. And of course, in the light of Mr. Bossi's recent activity, it is clear that regionalism in Italy can be converted into a kind of nationalism of resistance. But of course, to suggest that I've covered everything here is to ignore other cases, because another case which has to be introduced here is the case not where one nation has conquered another, but where a modus vivendi has been achieved between two groups, as in Belgium and in Switzerland, so that all the sort of theoretical developments that I have to put forth have to be supplemented by some sort of theoretical understanding of those other cases. But now I must turn to the question of the larger empire, the larger empires. And what we are many of the problems of contemporary politics are the problems which result from the collapse of the Habsburg, the Ottoman, the Tsarist, the Communist, the Mughal Empire, the British, Portuguese, French, Dutch, and Belgian empires overseas. Now, what happens in what is the normal situation now, the post-colonial situation? Of course, if I had an infinite amount of time, I would want to talk, first of all, about the theory of colonial societies. And I've done this in the later edition of my book called Race Relations in Sociological Theory, where I have a chapter called A Paradigm for Race Relations Research. But I'm talking about colonial society, and a lot of it is argument initiated by an intellectual engagement with the work of M.G. Smith, a man for whose intellect I had the utmost admiration. But I'm not going to talk about that. But in what I said there, in any case, I had to move on from talking about the structure of colonial societies to talking about the structure of post-colonial societies. And let me just say, leave that as something which I bracket away. I have written about it, and I assume that part of the totality of what I want to talk about consists of the adjustments which are made in post-colonial societies on many fronts. The sharing of power between the formerly subordinate ethnic groups, the perpetuation in those territories very often of the remnants of some sort of colonial civil service system, the existence of what Marxists used to call comprador bourgeoisies, who represent the interests of overseas investors. All of those things are there, and many structural problems are contained within the society. But one important problem, which I noted when I was talking about Scotland, Ireland, Wales, of course, is migration to the metropolis. And this is something which has always existed, but which is accelerated in the post-colonial situation. And it constitutes, of course, a special problem for the former colonial societies. For them, it represents a brain drain. For the people concerned, it represents a brain waste, because so many of them go to inferior jobs when they migrate. But I'm not really even going to discuss that. The filling out of the sort of theoretical model which I'm offering you would have to include all of that discussion of the theory of colonial and post-colonial society. What I have to talk about is the much simpler matter of migration to the metropolis, the simple fact of migration to the metropolis. And this, I suggest, has to be looked at, on the one hand, from the point of view of the migrants as to why they are moving, and secondly, from the point of view of the metropolitan society. Now, as far as the migrants are concerned, I have suggested here, let me say, I'm talking about basically economic migrants, because I'm going to have to say at the end, I've got to have a supplementary theory for political migrants. But I think of people in there, not universally across the former empire, but in certain parts of the empire, or the former empire, extended families wanting to improve their estate by taking up opportunities wherever they are. And the simplest thing, of course, is for them to go to the former metropolis. There will be former explorations of the possibility, as, for instance, the establishment of seamen's and peddlers' colonies in places like Cardiff, Liverpool, and so on. But then one gets the bigger migrations, and of course we in our work have been concerned especially with migration from the Caribbean and from the Indian subcontinent. And I have most immediate experience because these are the people I live with and who go to school with my children, whom my wife teaches, immigrants from the Punjab and particularly Sikhs. Here we have extended families trying to improve their estate. And to do this, they go to some other country. Now, that doesn't mean, however, that they simply go into competition with all other extended families, because in the land of settlement, they will use the markers of religion, language, and custom as an indication of who are the people they can rely on. And of course, in all such communities, the crises of life will be dealt with in the temple, the gurdwara, the mosque, the church. And so one has a picture of this migrant community which should not be seen, I'll make it very clear in this paper, which should not be seen in what people have come to call essentialist terms. One's not talking about an unchanging cultural pattern. That is a wrong perception, because the migrants have contained within themselves strong modernizing urges. What we call their culture consists of the organizations of survival which they establish, and those organizations are highly adaptive to the new situation in which they find themselves. That anybody who says multiculturalism, that means talking to the people about their culture, you're wrong there. What you will do then is that you will speak to elderly men. Whereas in fact, there is a continually changing form of social organization and culture. Actually, when I use the term culture here, I'm talking about all the practices which people develop in the process of surviving. I'm not talking about culture. This is one of the difficulties that one has, actually, when one talks about multiculturalism, because there are always a lot of arty people who come in and say, we're going to talk about whether the blacks have sufficient art galleries and so on. That is a permanent difficulty that I have. There is a set of problems there about the relation between cultures on that level, but I'm talking about this other level. And what I've suggested is that these migrant communities have three points of reference. One is the homeland. There is the question of remittances. There is the question of the recruitment of spouses. There is the question of maintaining some sort of educational link, and there is involvement in homeland politics. No one would deny that. At the same time, in the land of present settlement, there is the business of fighting for equality, fighting against what appears as racism, racial discrimination, and doing this sometimes as a group, sometimes in alliance with groups within the society of settlement. One of the costs of that for the immigrant community is that they lose some of their members who join the peer group culture and may retain some links. This is not a new problem. When the working class in England fought for equality, one of the elements of that equality that they sought for was the right of their children to get on by doing well at school, and then sometimes they lost them. And that is a feature of the migrant situation. But then, of course, there is the business of onward migration, because most sensible Punjabi families, when they're in England, are always looking at the opportunity of moving on to North America. And I was terribly reassured in that extraordinary place that New York is today by the fact that my taxi drivers, when they spoke to each other to find ways through the traffic, spoke to each other in Punjabi, and I felt at home and safe. But I think of it's wrong to use one's colleagues as data, but I think of one of my colleagues from a Sikh family who originally was a piece of data in a survey of Punjabi youth in Coventry, and he wisely saw that it wasn't very profitable being a piece of data, so he became a research assistant. And then he moved on from there to being an advisor to local authorities on ethnic matters, and then he just became an advisor to local authorities, and now he's in various quangos. He's put both of his children through private school, one doing medicine and the other doing, of all things, how globalized can you get, Japanese and law. But when he goes to the United States on one of his numerous fellowships, and he meets the Lithuanians and the Norwegians and other people there who say, oh, it's terrible here, I have this terrible sense of anomie. I didn't. I came back with 200 Punjabi addresses in the Chicago area. So that even amongst the most globalized, modernized people, this ethnicity plays a part. And it seems to me that is going to be a fact, whatever policies are imposed for several generations. But now let me turn to the other side of the coin, and that is the response of the European societies to such people, such immigrants. And one thing is perfectly clear. If one looks at Le Pen, or one looks at the Flamse Bloc, if one looks at the various British national parties and the National Front here, and if one looks at yesterday's successful candidate in the Austrian elections, Haider, that there will be a basic reaction in these societies of between 15-25% of people whose reaction to the presence of immigrants is to say, go home. Now, just as before, I didn't say I was going to comment on the morality of violence. I just want to draw attention to the fact that that is the case in Europe. And, of course, the major political parties faced with that situation do not simply stand up for the rights of man. They adapt their own policies to try to win votes back from such groups. So they are influential. Now, of course, looking at the needs of European societies, let me say that clearly anybody who looks at these advanced societies will recognize that they're going to need continued immigration. Of course, people used to say, with some truth, that it's not so necessary anymore. We have automation, and in any case, capital can go and search for labor rather than bringing labor to capital. But even in societies of the most advanced kind, there does seem to be need for a very considerable range of people who clean, who do the laundry, who deliver the pizzas, who do various beautician's jobs, and so on. And this was life for many of the people amongst whom I lived in New York 3 months ago, in one of the most advanced cities in the world. Again, I was in Bern in Switzerland, and formally the country is very hostile to immigration. But as I was sitting in the smart railway station where I asked my colleague to take me for a cup of coffee, he looked around and he said, "You see, all of these men sitting around here are immigrants, illegal immigrants, many of them, Turks, Moroccans, whatever, all sitting around. Because the society needs them, there is a demand for that sort of labor, and yet at the same time, those who want the labor in have to show that they are placing limits upon it. So that the policies which will be developed will vary on the part of essentially employers and their representatives in Parliament is to try to get immigrant labour, but to show that its supply is strictly limited. And of course, as far as the unions are concerned, the immediate reaction is likely to be one of excluding the immigrants who are potential competitors. But where one has some sort of corporate system, where the trade unions are involved in planning the economy, trade union leaders become convinced that for the economy to grow, they need such immigration. And so they have this task of selling this to their members. And they won't be completely successful. And the members will desert to the various nationalist parties. And then, of course, if one looks at the underemployed in the indigenous population, and the unemployed, and people who potentially could do the dirty jobs, but have been educated to believe that they shouldn't be in that sort of job. And here you have the basis, of course, of a degree of skinhead racism articulating with some of the parties of the far right, and that is going to be a feature of these situations. Now, in these terms, what is likely to be, what are the policies which European metropolitan states, many of them multinational, will be adopting towards such immigrants? And broadly, there are three policies. There's the one of the Gastarbeiter system in Germany, which is linked in a particularly dangerous and noxious way with an idea of German ethnic nationalism, so that one has the idea of a society in which a percentage of the population is differentially incorporated, and in which they are available as possible scapegoats. And I don't see very much progress being made on the process of accelerating the acquisition of German citizenship by the Turks, even though if one lives in Germany, as I've done quite a lot recently, one realizes how very German many of the young Turks now are. And then there is the, in a way, the other extreme, which was the case until recently, at least in France, of saying, yes, we're going to let you come, or within limits, up till the immigration stop, and there are a lot of you who've got here, not merely Algerians, but Portuguese and the like. What we want for you, we want you to have liberty, equality, perhaps a bit of fraternity, but liberty and equality anyway, and to become good Frenchmen. And we want you to lose your own culture. I could give you many of examples of this in my discussions with French people about research, that is the second alternative, which is assimilationism. And those who believe in the value of ethnic cultures would say ethnocide. The third alternative is multiculturalism, and that sounds splendid, but it can mean a sort of manipulative multiculturalism, Many people who believe in multiculturalism who don't believe in equality. I sometimes say that my fellow countryman, Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, was an arch multiculturalist, but he called it apartheid. That is a serious comment. There are many people who loosely use this term here, who are speaking in those terms. Now, obviously, what I have been trying to talk about in my own research is the kind of multiculturalism which emerges in the process of negotiation, which ethnic minorities want, at least for several generations, in their relations with their land of present settlement. Now, my last word of all is this. I said that the attempts to develop some sort of master concept, which I would offer you, are confined to a limited field only. It's perfectly clear when all of this has been said that there are a whole number of other situations. The great bulk of the people who are settling, of outsiders who are settling in metropolitan societies today, are not economic migrants, although they may be economic migrants in disguise sometimes, but are in fact people coming from disturbed political circumstances. And their relationship with the society is going to be different. They have different needs and a number of different kinds of needs amongst them. And as far as the politicians of the host society is concerned, justifying their presence is more difficult, because whereas you can argue that economic migrants are necessary for economic growth, in the case of real political refugees, you're talking about a moral and political obligation. And that's something which isn't easy to sell, because it's not in the nature of politics for people to be able to win support by advocating moral and political obligation. And so you see, I come to this conclusion. I think that in order to try to make order, to bring order into this sphere, this limited sphere, which has been involved in the relationship between ethnic and racial studies, nations and national, ASIN, Center for Research in Ethnic Relations, it is possible for us to begin to explore common concepts, but the great advantage of the sort of lecture that I've given is that I can really conclude by saying that insofar as I haven't covered everything, I've achieved my objective, because I have shown that in this process of theory building, if we start there, we then recognize the other areas which have to be added. And sooner or later, as your journal in its leading article shows, every university in some way or another is moving the study of ethnic and racial studies and nationalism to the center of things. I hope that I have made a small contribution to bringing some kind of limited order to that debate.
How to make sense of the diversity of the contemporary world. I think that John has given us a magisterial overview of some of the issues, particularly in relation to multi-ethnicity and multinationalism in contemporary Britain. I'm glad to say that the lecture will be published in the July 1997 issue of the journal in a fuller form, those of you who wish to consult it there. Immediately, I would like to invite you to join us at a reception in the senior common room on the fifth floor. I'm not going to take questions on this occasion, but if you have questions for the speaker, I would urge you to take them up during the reception. So thank you very much indeed, John, for a magisterial survey. Okay.